All right, welcome back to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. This is episode 137. All right, first the news. What I need to do right away is to say thank you to all the brothers from Doric Lodge number 732 for the hospitality and the opportunity to come there and present. I also have to thank all of the brothers who came out from all around the area as well. You all made it a very special night for me, and again, I cannot thank you enough. If anyone out there is in the Nashville area, try your best to get to see Doric Lodge 732. I believe they're open on Mondays, typically. It's such a great lodge. It's a beautiful lodge, and the brotherhood is amazing. Thank you again, brothers. It was a great trip. If you want to hear a bit more about the trip, keep your eyes peeled. Brother Brian Shimian of the Midnight Freemasons actually accompanied me down to Nashville. In fact, he drove both ways. So I have to tell Brother Brian thank you, because the company was just the best, and once again for coming with me. But anyway, Brother Brian wrote a piece for the Midnight Freemasons about the adventure that we had, and it'll be going up very soon. Just remember to check back frequently. We publish Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. You can sign up to get updates via email or follow us on Twitter at Midnight Mason, or you can find Midnight Freemasons on Facebook as well. So I hope you're all enjoying the live show, the Masonic Roundtable, which is on Tuesdays at 10/9 Central. It's like The View, except it's Freemasons and we talk about current issues within the fraternity. You all know by now that I am on the show, but it is hosted by the great John Ruark, who is a past master and just a tremendous guy. Also, Jason Richards, who has got to be one of the classiest brothers that I know, super smart. And of course, Nick Johnson, another past master, who is literally one of the funniest guys that I know. We geek out quite a bit on Masonic memes and other internet-related funnies. And of course, Brother Nick Johnson is also the brother behind the Millennial Freemason blog. And of course, Juan Sepulveda of the Winding Stairs podcast and the brother behind FreemasonryArt.com. So all kinds of personalities are there. It's all great stuff, and I hope you guys all decide to check it out. If you didn't catch it, or you can't catch it live, they are always available on YouTube.com/TheMasonicRoundtable. Speaking of shows and podcasts, please don't forget to show some love and check out Brother Rob Lewis's show, Far From Centered, which is on iTunes, but also he has another show called Center Mass, which is on Google Hangouts as well. Now you can find both of those via our links to them on wcypodcast.com. I want to let everyone know to please watch and share the recent dyslexia video that I put together for the Valley of Chicago's Metropolitan Dyslexia Center. The more you share it, the more we can get and help raise those funds to build a new facility. Also, you have heard me mention the dyslexia walk that's coming up, and you have asked when it's going to be. And I received the official dates just recently. They were released. So Saturday, May 31st, registration starts at 8 a.m. The walk is at 9, and refreshments and awards are at 11. And you can register today by going to the URL walkfordyslexia.org. So please do that. You guys always hear me talk about the Grand Lodge charities. Well, this month I received the new issue of the Grand Lodge magazine for the state of Illinois, and they decided that the whole magazine this month was going to be about the charities that we have been supporting, and I'd like to read you one small part of it. There's an article called Life at the Illinois Orphans Home. So I will do that right now. From the Illinois Freemasonry Magazine, Life at the Illinois Orphans Home by Agnes D. Cooper. IMOH stands for Illinois Masonic Orphans Home, but few of us were orphaned in the Dickensian sense, all alone in the world with no safe place to live and no one to care for us. Most had lost only one parent, but because of the Great Depression and World War II challenges to the U.S. economy, that was enough to create life-changing circumstances in many lives. Those of us in the home usually had a living parent, but the parent could not manage both the care and the support of usually more than one child. All of us had a father who was a Freemason, and therefore possibly eligible to enter the Masonic home. Although I didn't realize it until much, much later, we had an excellent life in the home. This is a sort of belated thank you to the lodges, which supported and cared for us so well. In order to understand how the home was able to take care of so many children, 125 to 300 children at different periods, it helps to understand their basic routine of our lives. We arose at 6:15 every morning, got dressed, had our beds checked to see if made properly, and went downstairs to our departments. There were 3 departments for girls and 3 for boys according to age. There, we tidied and cleaned, got ready for breakfast, and went to the dining room. We all had arrived at 7 a.m. We said the Lord's Prayer together, and while we ate breakfast, listened to classical music, quite a bit of Tchaikovsky. We had supervisors, one for each department, and bells to keep us on schedule. After breakfast, we got ready for school, and were off to the Cosset Grammar School and Lyons Township High School via a given route. Those in grammar school came home to lunch, while the high schoolers ate at the LTHS. After school, we returned and changed into play clothes. Starting at age 10, approximately, girls worked 3 weeks out of the four in either the laundry, kitchen, or dining room, and boys worked in the print shop, the large garden with sour apples, or cleaning various areas like the gym and the long tunnel from the main building to the laundry. After dinner, we had some free time before it was time for homework from 7 to 8 or 8:30 p.m. Bath and shower started at 8 and at 9 p.m. It was lights out for the oldest children, but earlier for the younger ones. During the summer, particularly, we used a large playground with tables and gym equipment, like slides, monkey bars, parallel bars, tennis courts, small and large basketball fields, and a wading pool for younger children. We would sit outside at big wooden tables and play pinochle and Monopoly. In the winter, we had sleds and could go sliding down a medium-sloped hill just past the tennis courts, and of course, we built snowmen. But life wasn't at all times routine. In the summer, we went once a week to a public swimming pool, Cermak Pool, which was deep enough for older children to try swimming. We went once a year to Swallow Woods, which was and is part of the forest preserve surrounding Cook County, and had picnics there. Every Saturday afternoon, year-round, weather permitting, we went to the movies at the LaGrange Theater. But in the winter, when the weather was bad, we had movies in the home's gym for everyone. Every Sunday, we went to the Congregational Church, except in the summer when we had church services in the auditorium at the top of the home, and where we also had Christmas programs. There were special times in the outside of the home. One time, perhaps more, we took the Streamliner, now in a Chicago museum, to downtown Chicago and saw movies. During my last fall in the home, we were taken to see the opera Il Trovatore at what is now the Lyric Opera, and we sat in box seats, a big thrill in itself. When the weather was nice, we had dances outside in the courtyard with a jukebox furnishing dance music. On Halloween, there was a large and awesome bonfire outside of the larger baseball field for all to attend and around which to parade in costumes. We watched until the fire went out. There were some unusual perks, like having two doctors, the doctor's car, who visited the home every day to attend to any kind of health problem from tonsillitis to boils. Amazingly, the home's children seemed, in retrospect, to have been pretty robust. The home had its own library with current newspapers, magazines, and books to check out with the librarian, Mrs. Davis, who was always helpful. We could study there also. I remember reading The Good Earth by Pearl Buck when I came to the home, wishing I could visit China, and finally did in 1994. We also had a home band directed by Mr. Donnelly, who somehow cajoled or just recruited us into playing into the band. I played the trombone and learned many, if not all, the Sosa marches, as well as hymns of the different armed forces. Sadly, the band would play when young men from LaGrange, including homeboys, had been drafted after graduating from high school. We would get into our uniforms and go to LaGrange Village Hall at 6 a.m. and send them off with the Sosa marches. Girls wore navy blue dresses with red and white striped navy collars, and boys wore navy trousers, white shirts, and red and white striped ties. There were probably 20 to 25 in the home band. There were many homeboys who went into the services and many who didn't survive the war. No one hid this information. We realized the war was real. We went to church on VE Day in May 1945. It was very emotional singing the Navy hymn. To be concluded in the winter 2014 issue of the Illinois Freemason magazine. All right, so as soon as that issue drops, I will of course finish that story for all of you. And so I know that you have heard me say it a million times, both on here and on the Masonic Roundtable, but support your Grand Lodge charities. And if you're in Illinois, consider joining the Society of King Solomon, which is a wonderful organization, and we're always trying to get our membership numbers up, especially in this particular area of the Society of King Solomon. All the money goes directly into the charities here in Illinois. That means the CHIP program, the MSA, which is the Masonic Services Association, and of course the Children's Homes, and Basic Relief for Brothers in Need. I'd like to thank you all in advance for your support of your Grand Lodge charities, no matter where you reside. So next, I would like to read a bit longer of a piece, but I found it interesting. Being a member of the Knight Templar myself, I receive the magazine each month, and there was an interesting article in this month's issue. I do want to say that although this article is from a Christian-based Masonic magazine, non-Christians and scholars alike will enjoy it. The Contentious History of a Holiday by Sir Knight Frank Conway, Ph.D. Did you know that the oldest, most revered religious festival of the Christian Church, a festival observed from the very beginning of Christianity, is named after a pagan deity, and that the Church has forbidden this festival to be celebrated on the calendar days on which it actually occurred? By the 2nd century AD, the Christian Church had become organized and powerful enough to begin establishing its own universally observed religious festivals. For the first 2 centuries of the Church's existence, there was only one such festival, a loosely observed commemoration of the suffering, death, and resurrection of its founder, Jesus of Nazareth. This series of events had become the first traditional religious observance among early Christians, a festival that had begun during the very first days of Christianity, one that predated Christmas by several centuries. The events that the festival celebrated lasted for 4 days, from the evening of the Last Supper until dawn of the day of resurrection. According to Matthew 28:1, the day after the resurrection occurred on the, quote, first day of the week, end quote, our Sunday. Counting backwards, that placed the Last Supper on Thursday evening. Now Jesus was a Jew, and the Last Supper was the first of 2 Seder feasts that opened the Jewish holiday of Passover. The celebration of Passover, an 8-day holiday, begins on the 14th day of the Hebrew month Nisan, March through April, usually the night of a full moon. Since the Hebrew calendar is lunar, the first evening of Passover, the first Seder feast occurs on a different date from the year to year. If the Church kept the date of the Last Supper on the first day of the Passover, the day of resurrection would fall on a different day of the week every year, and usually on a weekday rather than on a Sunday. The very early Christians in the Middle East had mostly been former Jews, so following the Passion and Resurrection of Christ according to the Hebrew calendar, by which they regulated their lives anyway, presented no problem. They just regarded the observance of Christ's death and resurrection as an addition to the Passover celebration. Many of these early Jewish Christian intellectuals looked upon Jesus as a very special man, the son of David, a man anointed by destiny to liberate the Jewish nation by virtue of his spiritual perfection that he had attained through suffering. He was their Messiah, or anointed one, directly descended from David and therefore the legitimate king of Israel. But many still regard him as only a man. Many Judaic Christians in the early Jerusalem church had not yet accepted the Pauline doctrine and did not regard Jesus as truly divine. Those who believed that he had arisen from the dead on the morning of the first day, and there were many who doubted this, did not credit the miracle to the divine power of Jesus himself. They thought that the resurrection had been entirely the work of God, done as a favor to his chosen one. Others considered the resurrection to have been a purely spiritual event, not the actual arising of Christ's physical body. These early Judaic Christians still followed the Jewish law and kept the Sabbath on Saturday. Sunday was just another day, as far as they were concerned. But by the 2nd century, many Gentiles had joined the church, and they saw Sunday as a special day, their Sabbath. They very much wanted to celebrate the Day of Resurrection on that day and no other. When some of these Gentiles succeeded to the papal throne, something clearly was going to be done. There were 2 divisions of Christianity in the 1st century after Christ, the Roman Church and the Eastern Church. The older of the two was the Eastern Church, centered first in Jerusalem and later, after the Roman destruction of the temple in Antioch. This church consisted almost entirely of Christianized Jews, and they began their observance of Christ's Passion on the 14th day of Nisan, no matter which day of the week it fell on. For this reason, they were called 14ers. In addition, they tended to focus their observance on the crucifixion, in which they saw Christ as the willing substitute for the Jewish Paschal Lamb, offering himself to the God to free the Jewish nation from the yoke of Rome. They discounted the resurrection that they saw as being celebrated on every Sunday of the year, in the Christian Mass anyway, with no need of having a special day during the Passover dedicated to it. So, if the day of resurrection fell on a weekday, it didn't bother them. Pope Victor, 189-199, disposed of the 14ers sometime around AD 190 with a stern letter to the Church of Antioch. If they wanted to remain in good grace with the much more powerful Roman Church, they would have to focus their observance on the Day of Resurrection, an all-important day to Gentile Christians. Also, henceforth the resurrection was to be observed throughout the Christian world on a Sunday, not a weekday. Although the Pope, as Bishop of Rome, had no real temporal authority at the time, the Patriarchs of Antioch saw the wisdom of going along with Rome, and they capitulated to Victor's demands. those Jewish Christians who continued to observe the Passover found themselves unwelcome in their own churches. One generation later, the 14ers had disappeared from church history. Sunday was now the official day of resurrection. The next question was, which Sunday? Should it be before the 14th or after? Should it have no relation to the Passover at all? At the Council of Nicaea, convened by the Emperor Constantine in AD 325, the bishops agreed upon the vernal equinox, the first day of spring, as the pivotal day. They decided that the day of resurrection would be observed on the Sunday following the first full moon or after the spring equinox. To determine this, they resorted to the astronomical science of the day. Now, everyone knew that the best astronomers in the Roman Empire were those who practiced in Alexandria, Egypt, so the emperor commissioned them to determine the exact day of the equinox. After careful consideration and many calculations, they came up with March 21st. The learned men of Alexandria labored under a considerable handicap, however. Although ancient Greek astronomers had long suspected that the Earth was round, Christian cosmology of the day was geocentric and held that the Earth was a flat disk with Jerusalem at its exact center. The disk stood at the center of the universe, and the sun, planets, and stars were thought to revolve around it. This led to some interesting results when Alexandrian astronomers tried to forecast the date of the full moon for years, or even centuries ahead. There was another provision. The full moon had to occur before the agreed-upon Sunday. If the full moon happened to fall on that particular Sunday, then the entire four-day holiday was to be postponed until the following week. Under no circumstances did Rome want our Lord's resurrection to coincide with the beginning of the Jewish Passover. Rather than an odd proviso, considering that Jesus had told his disciples, Luke 22:15, quote, "I have greatly desired to eat this Passover with you before I suffer," end quote. The church was already beginning the de-Judaization of its founder. The imperial backing of Constantine gave the Pope for the first time temporal as well as spiritual authority. He now had the military might of the Roman army behind his decrees. He no longer had to depend on stern letters and sermonic tongue lashing to make his point. The punishments for what he had come to be called heresy, literally the wrong choice, became much more severe, sometimes extending even to torture and execution. After Nicaea, the entire Roman world was celebrating the 4 days of the Passion, death, and resurrection of Christ at the same time, but there were other worlds besides the Roman one, and there was one more controversy that remained to be resolved. Sometime during the 17th century, the Roman Church discovered that it had yet another wayward Christian culture to contend with, the Celtic Church. Ireland had become mostly Christian by the year 500 thanks to the missionary work of the Patrick Bishop of Armagh. In the following century, Irish monks sailed over to England, Wales, and the islands off the west coast of Scotland, and found monastic communities along the seacoast. From those monasteries, many of which became respected centers of advanced learning, the Irish bishops and monks attempted to complete the Christianization of the British Isles that St. Augustine, along with a party of 40 monks sent by Pope Gregory, had begun in 597. They were not entirely successful, due partly to its geographical isolation and partly to the disintegration of the Roman Empire. The Celtic Church had developed largely on its own, outside the circle of the Roman Church's influence. Their brand of Christianity was considerably laid back and included many pagan Celtic practices and personalities of which Rome would have disapproved. For instance, recognizing that the Irish country people were especially devoted to the goddess Brigit, the bishops simply canonized her as Saint Brigit and turned her shrine at Kildare into a Christian church where nuns would keep her sacred oak fire burning for the better part of 1,000 years. The goddess's symbol was a sun wheel, shaped like a primitive swastika, traditionally woven from rushes that even today is hung over Irish hearths, and that can readily be purchased as a Brigit's cross in any store specializing in Irish goods. Celtic monks had their own form of tonsure, the hair on the front half of their head shaved off, and that on the back half allowed to grow long and untrimmed. They had their own eschatological traditions too, one of which held that in the second coming, Christ would be born as a woman. But the real sticking point with Rome was once again the date of the day of resurrection. The Celtic clergy, not having the benefits of astronomical advice from Alexandria, relied on complex tables of lunar cycles, which neither the Celts nor the Romans really understood, to make their holiday calculations. Consequently, the Roman and the Celtic day of resurrection were usually a week or two apart, with the Celtic one coming first. This meant that for decades, there were 2 days of resurrection celebrated in the British Isles, one in the Celtic date and one on the Roman date. The matter, a subject of heated disputes between all parties was finally resolved not by venerable bishops or holy monks, but by spat between a husband and wife. A local king, Oswy of Northumberland, had married the princess Enfled of Kent. She had been baptized on the Roman Resurrection Day, and she and her retinue all observed the Roman dates for the holiday. Oswy, on the other hand, still adhered to the Celtic dates. And as a result, he and his courtiers had usually broken their Lenten fast and were enjoying a hearty dinner of ham and mead and roast goose, while Enfled and her party still had a week of fasting to look forward to. As the aroma of Oswy's feast filled the castle, his queen was not amused. In addition, the Lenten rules of the time forbade sexual relations, even between married couples. Now it was Oswy who was not amused. This was an untenable situation, and it didn't take Oswy, egged on by his hot-tempered son, long to resolve matters. He presided over an ecclesiastical council held at Whitby, 20 miles north of Scarborough, on the North Sea coast in 663. There, he threw his support with the representatives of the Roman faction, and Rome carried the day. The whole Christian world was finally united in the observance of the death and resurrection of Jesus. Meanwhile, the Roman bishops had noticed an oddity on the part of their Celtic brethren. The local people, as well as the Celtic monks and bishops, kept referring to the day of resurrection as Easter Sunday. Easter? Who the Romans wondered was Easter? Another of the innumerable Celtic saints who populated Irish legends? Not exactly. The Celts were invoking the name of the Northern European dawn goddess, Easter. St. Bede, the 8th century scholar monk, tells us in his Ecclesiastical History of the English People, written around 731, that her name, quote, "she who appears in the east," is the Anglo-Saxon form of the Scandinavian Ostra, the Norseman's Eastur, or the Teutonic Ostern. These all became Easter in the language of Anglo-Saxon Britain. Her festival, Ostara, in German became Easter when the Germanic Saxons settled in England. It was celebrated on the dawn following the first full moon on or after the spring equinox and is thought to have been the beginning of the pagan Germanic year, just as Halloween was beginning of the Druidic year. Our month of April was called Easter's month in Anglo-Saxon. The holiday itself was called Easter's Blessing by the Saxon and Blessing for Victory by the marauding Vikings. Easter herself was represented in art as a tall, fair-skinned, blue-eyed, blonde woman who wore only a fishnet draped around her shoulders and stood holding out her left hand, offering her worshippers the apple of immortality. Her sacred animal was the rabbit, which was supposed to provide her worshippers with bright red colored eggs, a symbol of fertility to celebrate the joy of the returning warm weather. She was usually accompanied by a prophetic raven, an oracular bird that predicted the fortunes of the coming year. Sometime in the 12th century, the monks of Coventry Cathedral carved a scene on the choir seat that portrays a naked woman wrapped in a fishnet holding an apple and riding on a goat with a rabbit running by her side and black bird flying overhead. This image is Christianized today in old guidebooks where it is explained away as an early attempt to illustrate the legend of Lady Godiva. This is probably because the cathedral had been founded in 1043 by Leofric, Earl of Mercia, and his wife Godiva, but the woman in the carving is without a doubt the goddess Easter. Easter's festival meant that it was spring, when the villagers could begin planting their crops and when domestic and wild animals came into season and mated. In the early pre-dawn hours preceding her sunrise epiphany, the people built bonfires on the hillsides to welcome her. After the sunrise services, they decked themselves with flowers and danced around a tall pole, the maypole, as we call it today, that had a cut evergreen tree lashed to the top. The congregation then sacrificed a goat to the goddess and shared the meat among the poorer families. Easter was a form of the ancient Proto-Indo-European dawn goddess, Assos, or the Shining One, the most powerful and widely revered pagan deity whose worship had survived from the Stone Age Europe. She and her joyous spring festival were so beloved by the people of the northern countries that they did not formally abandon her worship until the 1400s. Centuries after they had adopted Christianity. Unknowingly, we have not totally abandoned it yet. To this day, in America, we still acknowledge her sacred rabbit with its colored eggs as an enduring mascot of the holiday. On the recent spring river cruise along the Rhine, the author has seen her maypoles, one in the center square of every German town and village, each pole bedecked with long colored ribbons for the people to hold as they danced, and each with a freshly cut pine tree at its tip. It is only in English, German, and a few other Northern European tongues that the holiday is still named after the goddess. In most other European languages, its name is some form of Pasque, such as the French Paquet or the Italian Pasqua, derived from the Hebrew of Passover. Since Easter's Epiphany occurred on the dawn following the first full moon after the spring equinox, the Church Fathers had decided to fix the celebration of Christ's Day of Resurrection on the dawn of the first Sunday after the first full moon following the equinox. The goddess' feast usually fit in quite nicely with the church's timing. This method of reckoning kept the Last Supper Seder in place on Thursday, and the crucifixion would always happen on Good Friday. Also, because it was pinned to the spring equinox, the holiday would usually occur close enough to the Jewish Passover to keep the seasonal relevance of the gospel accounts intact. So even though the Christian Easter was a movable lunar feast, it kept the sequence of daily events in the desired order, ending with the resurrection at dawn on the Christian Sabbath as desired. After the Reformation, Easter got short shrift from most Protestants, who looked upon it with suspicion as just another concession of Rome to accommodate converted pagans by replacing their accustomed holidays with Christian festivities, just another Halloween or a harvest festival of the Celtic god Lug, still celebrated in Ireland. Easter did not catch on in the American colonies for several generations. New England Puritans, who recognized that most of the holiday's secular customs smacked of a pagan springtime fertility rite, suppressed it along with Christmas. Then around the middle of the 19th century, America saw an influx of German, Irish, and Eastern European Catholics, all of whom celebrated Easter with gusto, even reinstituting the custom of dancing around the maypole. German immigrants, both Catholic and Lutheran, introduced their custom of coloring Easter eggs and hiding them in the forest for children to find. Many Protestants looked askance at all these outlandish goings-on. It was clear to them that these newcomers were having entirely too much fun for the people celebrating a solemn religious holiday. It looked as if they regarded Easter as just another excuse for a jolly feast complete with chocolate bunnies, jelly beans, and alcohol. Finally, after the Civil War, when all of America was in need of renewed hope and inspiration, both Presbyterians and Catholics led an initiative to revitalize Easter, and they managed to bring it into the American catalog of religious celebrations. Despite its pagan source, the goddess name has become established as the official name of the holiday in the English language. It is used by priests, bishops, cardinals, ministers, and even church scholars in their learned writings on the subject. We have Easter masses, Easter services, Easter candles, Easter sermons, Easter baskets, Easter parades, and of course, Easter Sunday itself. Perhaps the best way to end this article would be to wish all my fellow knights and their families a happy and a blessed Easter. All right, I hope you really enjoyed that. Now I will, of course, have that entire magazine in PDF format included with the bonus features of the episode. And how do you get the bonus features? Well, the answer is through the app. If you visit wcypodcast.com and click the tab at the top to support the show, you will see several ways you can support the show. And of course, the apps are there. The apps let you listen streaming, download the papers we read via PDF, and even give you Masonic wallpaper for your mobile devices. Also, there are a ton of other ways, like through our affiliate with Onnit Labs. If you like to stay focused and feel aware and just have that cerebral edge, our affiliate Onnit Labs has that. It's called Alpha Brain. It's something that even I use. So you can check out that flagship product of theirs, click through the links, and use the promo code WCY at the checkout. Also, my favorite affiliate of the two is, of course, FreemasonryArt.com, which has the best, classiest Masonic art around, and also is your source for real Masonic lambskin aprons, which are made by Brother Juan Sepulveda. Also, he'll even add custom art to them if you like. If none of that suits you, then consider a direct donation via PayPal. You pick the amount. You can even, if you felt like it, set up a monthly donation where you don't always have to come back and contribute again and again and again. In fact, one brother just recently did this, and he decided that he was going to set up a recurring donation each month. I didn't even know this was an option, but apparently it is, and he found out how to do it. So you can check that out also, and my eternal thanks to that brother for that continued support. So all those support links are going to be under the Support the Show tab on WCYpodcast.com. So next is this week's famous Freemason, John Winthrop Hackett. Sir John Winthrop Hackett is born on the 4th of February in 1848, and he passed away the 19th of February, 1916. He was a proprietor and editor of several newspapers in Western Australia, a politician, and a university chancellor. Hackett was born in New Bray County, Wicklow, Ireland, the eldest child of Reverend John Winthrop Hackett and his wife, Jane Sophia Monk. He was educated at the Trinity College in Dublin. Winthrop graduated with his bachelor's in 1871 and a master's in 1874. He was called to the Irish Bar in 1874, but immigrated to Sydney, Australia in 1875, where he was called to the New South Wales Bar in that same year. On August 3, 1905, Hackett married the 18-year-old Deborah Vernon Brockman, and they had four daughters and a son, also called John. John would also become Sir John Hackett, a popular and distinguished general in the British Army. The University of Western Australia opened in 1913 with Sir John as its first chancellor, and he gave it its first substantial private contribution when he endowed the Chair of Agriculture. Hackett's partner, Charles Harper, died in 1912, suffered from Parkinsonism, and his health began to fail in 1915. He took a trip to the eastern states, which appeared to have benefited him. However, he died suddenly on the 19th of February 1916 of a heart condition and was buried in the Caracatta Cemetery. Hackett was given the honorary degree of LLD by the Trinity College in Dublin in 1902. Under his will, a bequest to the Church of England paid for the building of St. George's College, the first residential college within the University of Western Australia. After provision for his widow and children, the residue of his estate went to the university, which received the sum of £425,000. £250,000 of this, with accrued interest, was used for the erection of a group of buildings which included Winthrop Hall and Hackett Hall. Another £200,000 was used to set up the fund, which still provides scholarships, bursaries, and other financial help for deserving students. The suburb of Hackett in Inner North Canberra, Australian Capital Territory, Australia, bears Hackett's name in recognition of his efforts to support the Federation of the Australian Colonies, which took place in 1901. Streets and a suburb in Perth are also named as Hackett or Winthrop. He was, at a point, the Grand Master of Western Australia. That's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook and follow on Twitter. Check out the Midnight Freemasons, the Masonic Round Table, the Winding Stairs, Far From Centered, PB&J Water, and Fraternal Ties. Please remember, if you like this show and you want to help out, check out those support the show links. And thanks again for listening, everybody. Stay on the level. And for Wince Camu, I'm Robert Johnson.